Hello, Yes But Why listeners. This is your host, Amy Jordan. Welcome to Yes But Why, episode 253, my chat with Nick Byrne, one of Australia's most prominent improv teachers and producers. But first, let's talk about our sponsors. Today's episode is, of course, sponsored by Audible. Get your free audiobook download and your 30-day free trial at audibletrial.com/yesbutwhy. You know what? I'm going to say it. Every day you don't have Audible, you're blowing it. It's like the new way of books. So listen up. Go to audibletrial.com/yesbutwhy and download that app and sign up. You get a free audiobook like right away. Plus, there's so much included content once you sign up. Seriously, it helps you, it helps me. What do you say? Our other sponsor for today's episode is PodcastCadet.com. My husband, Chris, and I run the company PodcastCadet.com. Maybe you've heard of us? Oh yeah? Well, we can help you with your podcast. We can give you a little push, or we can help you with the production of all of your podcast episodes. Contact us now at PodcastCadet.com. Hey, and you know what? Drop a note with promo code YBY20 to get 20% off the first service or workshop you buy. This week on Yes But Why, we talk to Nick Byrne, the artistic director of both the Impro ACT Theatre in Canberra and Australia's international impro festival, Improvention. In our conversation, Nick gives us a glimpse of the world of a traveling improviser. We talk about mixer shows, festival marketing, and audience connection. Nick tells me how Improvention is built for improvisers by improvisers. Support Nick Byrne. Australia, Nick says, is almost back to normal, so Aussie listeners, swing on by Impro ACT and take a class. And hey, other international listeners, you and me, we can still check out impro.com.au to check out the online workshop options. I now present to you Yes But Why, episode 253, Nick Byrne and Turning Challenges into Opportunities. Enjoy. I'm Amy Jordan, and this is Yes But Why Podcast. Yeah.
We're up to a higher rate now, so I'm expecting that this year we'll be able to do almost normal local shows and courses. Obviously, any of the international invitations, such as the festival I ran, or any of my international touring work is still completely off the cards, which is a big change in a lot of ways.
So hard for people who, like, it's like a big part of their, you know, usual income flow, you know?
Well, it's important in a range of ways. There's the income flow, but, you know, also the motivation. I'd been inviting international guests here for a long time and been organizing the international festival that was here in Australia. I guess I was something of a international convener for Australian improv. And so I knew all these top people that came from all over the world on really still then quite a limited budget, because I guess people like to come to Australia, and I got lucky. But I never placed myself in that same category until eventually there was kind of nowhere else to go but to put myself out there on the international circuit and see how it went. So when I discovered that actually I could play a valid role doing the touring, it was very important to just feel that level of acceptance and peer support and feedback from people from different countries and cultures that sort of validated your existence after what I guess a lot of people who are not only improvisers but are constantly attempting to organize bigger events, you know, you do a lot of work, perhaps a little less performing, and you know, you I guess there's always that self-reflection of how you fit into the picture. So for me, one of the big losses is, you know, I'm now just a local drama teacher at the moment, you know, in terms of putting on my improv classes. Whereas before I got that extra motivation of being a guest in people's town and this sort of thing.
I think you still maintain the notoriety. Don't worry. You know, you're still, well, you're still high level, to be, you know.
You're very kind, Amy, but it's going to be, it will be very interesting when things change again, because of course with the online environment, I guess I was mainly touring the European and Asian festivals and companies, and I think you could certainly put into a reasonably small packet, including including the Americans that would come to that circuit, you know, what you could call the usual suspects when you came up to a festival. Lots of people doing that work, but I guess there's a package of people that you could consider the usual suspect. Well, now, of course, so many great young tech-savvy people have had the confidence to run, you know, hundreds, thousands of Zoom classes and so on. And no doubt a bunch of them will be just as good as any of the rest of us, just as interesting as any of the rest of us, lots of new ideas. So I'm thinking those people should have the confidence now to get on the circuit and travel and enjoy themselves when all this is over, if they can. So it'll be interesting to see whether we're the old crew commanding a little bit of older generation respect and still getting the Guernsey, or whether in fact, you know, we will have been to some degree superseded by all these fantastic new people. Either way is great. You know, I'd love to see the more diverse ideas we can get out there, the more interesting things end up happening on stage, and the more we all continuing to be better teachers as well as presenters.
One of the things I think will happen is not that one will displace the other, but rather it's almost like new formats are being created, you know, like all of a sudden somebody's like, let's do this. And like, let's not lie, in like 8 years when we're not really doing, when it's not like so ubiquitous to be on Zoom, there'll be a format called like the Zoom. You know, like just an online situation. You'll try to do it, because I feel like it's not that, you know, people online are taking away from the live thing. No, they're literally, I mean, most of them feel like they're just there as a, like, you know, sad substitute to the, you know, experience of us all being together in a room. Right. But other people have said that, you know, it's almost like its own new art form, right? So, like, it's really just a new way to use this, you know, way of thinking, this a style of theater. And, you know, every new person I talk to, I learn a new form they have and a new, you know, this person, I read the book and that's what made me, oh, great. You know, so it's like all sorts of different inspiration and all comes together. And now, because we can all talk to everybody sort of globally in a much more open way, it's like passing ideas is like, I don't know, it's just flowing so much more country to country. It's not like, oh, well, you know, in Norway, they really do like dramatic improv and it's really like they don't care about the comedy. Oh, but here, you know, Germany's got some good comedy. You know, it's not like Chicago style, but, you know, like everyone has their like thing that they say is, oh, this area, that area. I feel like it's mixing now and it's going to be like, oh, we have this, you know, devised theater piece over here. And, oh, we're doing playback theater over there. And like, oh, yeah, they do, you know, the Chicago style improv at this place. And, oh, and they're doing this like deeply dramatic spot over here. You know, you can do all of it. And I feel like it'll be hopefully better, you know, for the art. Yes,
well, I think this is a, absolutely. And I think, you know, geographical labeling was certainly very, very true when I started up and started to connect groups and hold festivals and so on. I think that was true, but the advent of more and more festivals and more touring artists is what has introduced the diversity. And now, of course, it's super simple because you just turn on your computer. So what I think is really important in that area is having groups be open to diversity and trying something completely different. I think where things are still in a particular style, they are places where lots of people, or perhaps for a long period of time, one particular style has been taught, and they're very good at that style, of course, after that many people or that much time. It's kind of like, you know, someone of my age probably does a lot less snowboarding than they do skiing because, you know, we already learnt to ski and you've got to use all that time, those 2 days, learning to do it on one board instead of two skis. So I do think some places have a little bit of a fear of trying completely new ways, but that's extremely healthy. And to be honest, I've really enjoyed the European festivals in that regard because, you know, most of the, or a lot of the countries are of similar size and influence. No one has any reason to suspect that someone from this city or that country has anything less or anything less innovative to offer than anyone else. So it makes complete sense at those festivals to get as many different crazy ideas as you can. Well, one of the things I love about that circuit too is that it's become more project-based. I think when I started my festival, I didn't know how other festivals operated. I just needed to work out a practical way to get people to this very far away corner of the world within an achievable budget and, you know, get as much happening as possible. So it was totally natural to me that what I would do is invite one great teacher, director, performer from all sorts of different places. So when they came, I don't know, do you refer to them as mixer shows when you have people from all different groups doing a show together?
I've heard all sorts of phrases. Yeah, so mixer phrases. Makes sense. Yeah. You know, I thought like pretty much, I guess, jams is what I've heard, but that can refer to all sorts of different things. So yeah,
well,
I
almost
mean, mixer
all,
makes sense. I'm with you.
Well, almost all of our performances were, in a sense, mixer shows, but not in a jam sense. Essentially, great teachers taught their workshops. and they selected from other great visitors or people they just liked from their workshop who's learnt, they've learnt the stuff. And these were the formats for, you know, 90% of the festival shows.
Love it. That's so great.
It really, well, I didn't realize it was different to what other people were doing. I thought it was the obvious way to do it. Of course, I quickly learned that in those days it wasn't the case. But some of these really well-known players that I was very, you know, excited and privileged to have out here, they actually went back to their places of origin going, oh, man, you've got to go to that festival. I sang with a band for the first time, and I did this weird organic physical piece for the first time. And I'm thinking, what? You know, you're this really well-known person, and you've had these firsts, which made me feel wonderful. But the fact that they would then advertise the idea, and a lot of the festivals in Europe now, and Asia, much more a combination of, you know, like when I first went on the circuit, nearly every show in most of the festivals I went to was, yes, a team, if you like, from wherever the group had come, puts on their show, and then the next one, then the next one. Now, you know, a lot of the festivals have gone kind of 50-50. Nearly all of them have a mixer show component for at least students to get a leg up. In recent years, there's been this project focus. So because we have these usual suspects visiting all the European festivals, there are people on the circuit that I've played with in, I don't know how many cities, lots of different cities. So people will form a team, if you like, of three or four people who all live in completely different countries, but come together at a festival and they have their special project format that they do. And they might only do that two or three times a year when they go to different festivals that they all go to. And they might have three or four projects with other groups of people. So it's like having a team. You just don't, you know, share the same city. So that's really interesting. And I think the Zoom component is just the next contributor to this growing innovation. But I will just underline all of that by saying I absolutely believe that diversity of thought is what drives us, and it makes no sense to me, apologies to those who do this, it makes no sense to me to attempt to nail a particular style or format if what we are actually learning in our classes and teaching in our classes is a mindset that creates an adaptability to change, which is just, you know, an essence of spontaneous behavior and improvised theater. Why on earth would we want to perform the same format or the same style over and over and over? Those two ideas just don't make sense to me. I'm someone who likes to experiment and fail 50% of the time.
May I posit an idea of why they do those kinds of things?
Yeah, sure.
So I love the style of your festival because it really creates an atmosphere in what I actually usually say to my students when I'm teaching them, which is improv's going to be more fun for you than the audience because you're doing it. You're having the experience. You're part of it. The audience is feeding off of your excitement. They're enjoying what you're doing, but 100% you're the people having the most fun in the room, right? And so audiences are mostly just there to support you or to just like feed off of your energy in that moment, enjoy whatever ideas come out of your brain. Oh my God, I can't believe they thought of that. And usually it's most audiences are filled with other improvisers. So I love the idea that your festival essentially says, come here, learn new stuff, and then like, let's celebrate education and show people what it is that we have learned. And then all these new people get to meet each other. And even if they didn't take the workshop, they can go see the show and like kind of get what the thing was that got learned. And so that's cool too. Like, so it's sort of for the improviser. It's a festival made by improvisers for improvisers, right? The whole experience is so that like, it's an educational thing.
I would definitely agree that my own personal focus is for the growth of the participants. Absolutely. The capital of Australia, Canberra, is only 500,000 people. It's not a massive city. Sydney and Melbourne are like 5 million each and so on. So there's, quite some, I guess, audience development opportunity. But I live in a city where most people are on good incomes. They have very, very diverse opportunities and activities for such a small place. There's lots of things they can go and do. So, yes, I had a participant-focused festival, and I actually obtained a larger amount of the festival funding through participant packages full of workshops. In a week, if you did every workshop session over, the maximum length of the event was 9 days, I think was the longest one, but you could do a morning and afternoon workshop that were, 3 hours at each. If you did it that way, every one of those 9 days, and they could all be different. So you could potentially have come and done 18 workshops with completely different people, different guests in a week, if that's the way you wanted to do it.
Sounds like improviser Valhalla. I'm into it. Yeah, love it.
Something like that. Yeah. So I did have, I definitely had this education and growth focus, and I think people get not just theatrical growth, of course, but personal growth out of it. But what I would say about the audiences is you develop a different type of audience expectation. So as you say, they do feed off the excitement of the ride you are on. So if what you do is get a lot of great improvisers in a room, or any improvisers, in fact, and you put them in the situation of maximum risk by trying a show that is extremely experimental, then and coming out of, one workshop perhaps, then what you are doing is, yes, you are risking absolutely that the quality is going to waver up and down in a theatrical sense, perhaps. However, that factor of the audience being on the ride is dramatically increased. So you are creating a type of audience that is thriving more on that, a less judgmental audience of whether that line was funny or that was done really well, and more an audience of, oh my God, what's going to happen in the next 5 minutes? And if you do this with, so some of the shows were very mixed casts and some of them were highly selective. It was entirely up to individual directors of each show, how they wanted to cast these things. Apart from a general attempt as artistic director to pick a bunch of directors who would be diverse in their choices in that way, I did not attempt to stick my nose into that end of it. So a bunch of the shows were also just all high-end guests from, might be six people from six different countries, but they were all high-end improvisers. Now, at first, they hadn't been used to this kind of thing. And yeah, they were a bit thrown by doing completely different things. They might have been great at their mime style, or they might have been, you know, just great with the verbal comedy and so on. But, and then they're all put together. But now that this type of activity has become more common, if you get people who are really strong in the fundamentals of improvisation and are now relaxed about the fact that, yeah, every festival I go to, I'll do two shows that I've got no idea of what I'm doing before I arrived at the festival, they get over that concept as well, and they perform at just as high a level doing the completely new thing as they do when they're performing in a concept they're used to. So quality-wise, there are pros and cons, and you just develop a different type of audience and a different type of improviser who's ready for anything. That is my bent. I don't think about it or worry. I certainly don't put myself at the top of the tree in a range of skills that you might be able to measure. However, I do not care what sort of show somebody puts me in at a festival. I can do it without worrying. And the reduction, if you can improviser to essentially nil, so they're relaxed and they're energized, ready to go, and really looking forward to doing something that they have no idea of, they will perform pretty well. They'll perform at their best level.
You know, I think that you establish a comfortable atmosphere for everybody to perform. And I think that's probably why people, A, come back over and over to your festival. And then, you know, B, can just jump into anything. I totally 100% agree with you that the like essence of what we're teaching with improv is essentially like a lifestyle choice. And it's like, can you go with the flow? I mean, I'll tell you what, I am very glad I have these skills right now in my current life, right? And it's just like to be able to adjust and to change and to figure out how, you know, it goes. Now, I wanted to make one note, which was about the shows that you mentioned that do forums over and over. I think that's when theaters are more concerned about making money with shows than they are about the, like, you know... Not that it isn't good to work on a certain style, but at the same time, like shows, when they do like every week, there are different shows and they do like certain forms. You know, on Mondays, it's this, and on Tuesdays, it's that. It's really just to draw audience in. Because, like I mentioned before, my theory is that the performers are having more fun than the audience. But when you give a form to the audience, you then give them a puzzle they have to solve. They know, they expect it works out this way. They kind of get it in whatever way their audience brain gets what they're watching, right? It, like, for instance, the Herald format is a lot like television sitcoms, right? They're written very similarly. So you can get into the rhythm of it. And as an audience member, be like, oh my God, something is about to happen. And boom, there it is. Like, you can be in on the rhythm, and then you're playing the game with the people. It helps bring them in. It's part of like this, you know, hooking the audience with this style and like getting, making them part of it. It's almost like long form theater sports games, you know, like it's not theater sports, but it certainly is something where it's like, hey, audience, are you guys like with us? Do you want to like help us? Give us a story that we can then build a whole thing around your story. And then they're in on it and they're part of it. And it's like a thing. So it's, I think, really more a marketing situation. I mean, I think it was born out of education, because I like using formats to highlight a certain style, like a certain thing that I'm teaching. You know what I mean? Like, oh, let's do characters. Okay, we're going to do a thing where we do like a slacker, and you guys have to talk to, you know, you talk to this character, and then that character is going to talk to somebody new, you know, just to use it in a way that like helps them as an exercise. And then it's like, oh, did you guys like that exercise? Cool. You know what? You guys can do that if you want for your recital show. And they're like, we can? Like, sure, sure you can. like, even as a way almost for, because I have my favorite and my most teaching is level one. Oh my God, I love a noob. Tell me you've never heard of improv. Let's talk about it. Like, I just really enjoy that. And so my thought is, like, whatever you can do to make a new improviser feel comfortable. So there's a lot of nets you put out for them. You're like, hey, what about this? Hey, you know, try this rule. Don't do this. No questions. Just try that. Just try it. And it's like, they'll go, well, can I just ask a question? You're like, sure you can. That was just a weird little rule we tossed in to make it interesting, you know? And it's also, when I finish teaching level one, right before their recital, I go, everything I taught you is just rules to help you guys figure it out. No matter what happens up there, whether or not you break every rule I've told you, you're going to be okay. And they're like, what? And then I'm like, you're going to be great. You guys have handled it. And they're like, okay, great. So it's just frameworks to get the audience and the performer to feel more comfortable, you know, in the early stages.
I think it's true. It's one way. I mean, there's two different things there. You're talking about the audience and the performer. I'll go to each, but I think they're both sort of, it's stylistic as well as it's absolutely a marketing choice, without a doubt. But I think it's, and it's always going to be the case, it's an easier marketing choice. So essentially, it's very easy to sell to people, look, you're going to come along to a thing where you don't have to work very hard and you're going to laugh every 10 seconds or 30 seconds and so on. And as you say, it's going to be in a format that you can predict what this format is. If it was, for example, a theater sports style thing or a Harold in places where people have done a lot of Harolds. So you know basically what you're getting, and we're going to give it to you, and we've learnt that well. So that's an easy marketing sell. But I would differ in a little bit on the idea of, I think that's one way to hook an audience. It's definitely easier to get them there that way. But I err towards perhaps the, you know, I don't like to put words in people's mouths, but the Randy Dixon style, where basically, if you give the audience just enough to hook them in, just enough, but they have to actually think about what's going on here, and they're surprised about what happens next, but you're allowing them to become their own storyteller, then they're really engaged. To me, that is audience participation. If you say to an audience, oh, can I have a kitchen implement, and they say spatula again, and off you go, that's for me, that's fast food participation. But if two characters meet, they begin to develop a relationship, and then perhaps suddenly one of them is inexplicably not there anymore. Well, now the audience brain is going, oh, why aren't they there? Everyone in the audience is coming up with different solutions to that problem. However, they are absolutely engaged in the piece and becoming part of the story themselves, and they'll either get surprised to find out they've made the right choice, or they'll get the same jolly as the other type of show by they'll get surprised, sorry, to find that they it wasn't the right choice, or they can congratulate themselves that they did make the same choice as the improvisers. And even more specifically, at the end of the show, in the foyer, instead of their conversation being, well, that was fantastic, anyway, the babysitters are coming soon, so we better get home, the conversation is, no, she left him because of his affair with the so-and-so. Oh, no. Why she left him was because of that job in Europe. Or and so people will stick around and talk about the theater in the same way that they would with a a play that would be considered of critical acclaim. So you can put on a sometimes I refer to it as the difference between Hollywood and Cannes, if you like. It's just a stylistic difference. You know, in a Hollywood blockbuster, we're going to tidy up the end, probably even give you an epilogue, make sure you knew exactly what happened and how it went, and you'll be able to go home safe and tired, not have to think about that show again, other than to say, I had a great time at it. Or you can watch some weird European thing that just, oh, suddenly it's finished. Where was the end? But exactly. You might talk about it with your friends for 3 hours afterwards before you can think about going to sleep. So I think that way, when I think about the audience, with the students, I absolutely agree with you. My favorite class, in fact, I think it's my last personal post on Facebook, the class I look forward to more than any other, and I'm generally teaching myself 4 classes a week in different levels, even when I'm just here at home, as I now need to be. yeah, that beginner's class is the first one, the one I really look forward to more than anything else. However, the way I've taught introductory improv has changed markedly over the years in my approach, chiefly mindset-wise. So I spend a lot more time teaching beginners about the mindset concepts, so that I guess they're getting, you know, I don't know, indoctrinated or hypnotized into the right frame of mind. They don't need to. You can teach the rules of a game or an exercise and repeat it as often as you like. There's a big difference between knowing concepts. You know, most of our concepts are super simple, aren't they? They're really simple concepts. The problem is not understanding the logic of a concept. The problem with these mindset concepts is that you don't believe they will work for you, because there's something not good enough about you as a human to be able to achieve it. So if you teach the mindset a bit more focus on the mindset, so that people actually believe and have had demonstrated to them, yes, this concept works and I can do this concept. Well, you can teach them the rules to any game and they'll succeed at it straight up. But you can teach them 100 games, and if their mindset isn't right, they won't do any of them.
You know what I usually tell them? My students, when they're like, oh, I don't know if I can do this, I'm like, I always say this. I said, this is a natural ability that you have. It's there. You just don't have it right now because you're an adult and the world and everything has gotten in the way between you and your natural state of play. So like, you can't tell me that you can't do it, because I can guarantee like 1,000% that you have. And, and so you just need to find a way to slough off the, you know, all of the, oh, I don't know if I can do this, that you've developed since you turned 13 and all these hormones were like, let's go in there and mess up this body. And then, and so, you know, I try to give them that reassurance so that when they do it, I'm like, it might take a while. I also go, listen, you might not feel like you like got it by the end of our class, like the end of the full course. And that's all right. It is inherent in you, and you just need to keep working on it to like open the door, to like keep, you know, keep scrubbing, and you'll be able to reveal, oh my goodness, did you guys know that this was red paint on the inside? Oh my God. You know, like it's there. So just, it, you know, wait and keep working and you'll get there. That's my
Yes, and different theory. Different aspects are there for different people. So, oh, who knows how many skill sets that we have or mindset concepts. Let's say 10 of each. could be any number. Let's go with 10.
Sure.
It's apart from perhaps a couple of super basics, you know, in the accepting offers department and so on. Apart from some real super basics, in most of the skills and most of the mindset concepts that we teach, regardless of what school we're coming from, if there were 10 of them, if you do any three of them quite well, you're going to look good.
Right?
So if you compare yourself, if you compare yourself to other people all the time, you always see what they've got that you haven't. So you can be an exceptionally good improviser without being able to mime getting out of a box or even convince anyone that you're holding a cup of tea. You can't. I advise improving your physical skills. We can work on that. But you can get by as an improviser without being able to sing in tune. You can you can be extremely good with a sample of the skills required, and that we're all diverse and that we're going to have different qualities to each other. So totally. I like to do exercises that will show that people are thinking differently, and then say to them, and this is good. We're not trying to teach you to think in any homogenized way, other than perhaps, there may be more than this, but the big one that I say is what we do want you all to believe and understand and be comfortable with is that the person that you are working with and the next person and the next person think differently to you, and that's great. So you're constantly going to come up against different minds. If all we could all get as a skill is that we accept the way that any different sort of person might think as a you know, great possibility of a way to think, we're going to be fine. One of the hallmarks of my favorite improvisers around the world is, of course, any beginners, sorry about this next statement, but there are more useful offers than others. You know, you are kind of always right, but some offers are more inspirational to some people than others. And when you watch really great improvisers, you cannot detect that. What happens on stage was just the last thing that happened. And there's no detectable difference in their ability to take that offer and to deal with it. It might be more or less useful in some sort of measurable way. They don't care. It's the offer that happened, and that's what they're using and continuing with. If every improviser could just get that mindset, for example, that everything would be very easy on stage to do. It's this battle that our thoughts are different to other people, or this worry that our thoughts aren't good enough that stops us doing almost any show.
Oh, yeah.
For example, I can't speak a lot of almost any foreign language, but the last language, the last place that I worked just before lockdown was in France. I did a 2-hour narrative long form with two wonderful French guys, and I don't speak French, and it was fine. it's not a requirement that you have the skills that the particular skill sets that you think you need to have. It's a requirement that you are comfortable enough to go with the flow. Yeah.
Hmm. Ooh, what an extreme example. I like that. That was solid right there. Oh man.
It's quite common. I've noticed in the European festivals now, I'd say in most of the festivals I've been to recently, there will be some sort of show in the program to illustrate this point where they have got their main guests from different countries together, and it will be some sort of language-based show. Maybe not as extreme as that example, but it will be something like, okay, each of the guests will introduce a scene, and the rule is they can never speak in their own language, or it'll be, you know, some component that shows that these top performers do not need to understand what the other people are saying to achieve a good result.
Oh, I mean, yeah.
We already know this is true. I mean, what improv groups do you know who don't use gibberish? It just creates a different set of parameters to work with, and we fool ourselves that so many things are problems. We need to pull out the idea that challenges are problems. They're opportunities. Just like mistakes, they're opportunities. Oh, I don't know how to do that. Here's my chance to do a great show.
Oh, man. What a great point. I really appreciate that. Man, this has been such a great conversation. I feel like I'm getting like a personal masterclass. Well, except for that I'm going to publish it on the internet and then everybody gets this awesome little masterclass from you. It's really been very great to chat with you. May I ask you one more thing?
Thank you. Great to talk to you too. Yeah.
Oh, good. I'm so glad. I'm so glad you're having a good time. That's all I want to do. One more question I wanted to ask you is where in your life did you find the inspiration to do this? And not just like to start a festival, but like what got you into improv? Like what led you into that? It seems like you've done a lot of, you know, theatrical stuff in your life. You're very much a performer throughout, but like you very much locked into improv. What was the thing or the moment where you were like, oh my God, this is my thing?
Yeah. So certainly it's not the moment I started improv. That's certainly not it. I mean, it was just I'd been performing for a long time. I was more of a musician when I first left school, though I did have theater experience as well. And then musical theater took over, and then scripted theater took over, and then eventually, you know, with all the things we do as artists to survive all the other parts of the industry that by the time you get to my age you've had to do or enjoyed doing. I should say, very lucky. So I was introduced to improv just by another theater-based friend who said, listen, I'm trying out this. Do you want to come and join me? It was no massive inspiration to join. And in fact, we started a little branch in the then somewhat regional area, quite close to Sydney really, but somewhat regional area that I was in for a couple of years, and I enjoyed it, but I enjoyed it a lot, but I wouldn't say it was hooked. In fact, I went back to more scripted theater just through opportunity. But when I came down here to Canberra and started up something here, the difference I have to say is the change that it made in people's lives. So I'd always been someone who was extremely interested in the theatrical component, trying to make great performances and so on. But just the more it went on, and I mean, it's largely hobbyists that will take classes in this town, more than people who will become full-time professionals. They're doing it for a wide range of reasons, but to actually have a job where most days you go and do something and someone reports to you some positive development in their life because of the mode that you've been lucky enough to become a teacher in. You know, it's not necessarily the person, the teacher, it's this art of interaction that we've broken down and analyzed, that we can help people be able to communicate more effectively, more confidently, with more authenticity, with more self-belief. that is the art of improvisation, which allows people to do a great job on stage, but also affects them off stage. And when you do a job that people report positive benefits in their life off stage, most days that you go to work, how could you leave that? Who gets that? Who gets that joy, that feeling that you've got a job that is worthwhile? That's the thing that I can't leave. I'd have to say, beyond the theater. Yeah.
Wow, that's so amazing. What a great way to have been able to take that in. You know, I mean, I know it's tough when, you know, sometimes you're like, oh, I guess I'm just a theater teacher. But it is so great that you have found this way to look at it, you know, such that, it, you know, you get to help people and give them, you know, more confidence. That is such a great way to look at how this whole thing goes, and a great way to keep you in when it gets, you know, really tough. It's like, okay, this is tough for me, I'll give you that, but I'm going to stick with it because of all the people that it seems to help. And that's just killer. Great. So fun.
Yeah, it's a very, very lucky thing to find, and there's always room for more of it. So, I mean, I encourage anyone listening who's looking for a pathway. Well, yes, there's a very strong chance that you're not going to retire to the Bahamas on this. However, if you authentically approach learning to share this craft, and when I say authentically, I mean a desire to grow the craft and your own skills in the craft more than a desire to just have a successful company and an audience appeal and so on. If you approach it as your own journey in that regard, you will get really good job satisfaction out of it. So it's a worthwhile path, and I think it's going to be more and more and more needed in this what's going to be, you know, overly cautious COVID and post-COVID world. So let's all get out there and bring people closer together again.
Absolutely. Oh, Nick, thank you so much for being on the podcast. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you, Amy. It's a pleasure to talk to you, and I really hope I can get to Austin sometime. I hear wonderful things about the scene down there, and the city too. It's obviously quite a vibrant arts city that I haven't been to yet, so I'll be very keen to see what goes on in Austin.
Oh, definitely. And it is a vibrant improv town, maintainedly still holding strong. So I think that they would really love it to have somebody as accomplished and great as you to come in. So awesome. As soon as we can travel, it's happening, guys.
Yeah, that's right.
Thanks for listening to Yes But Why Podcast. Check out all our episodes on yesbutwhypodcast.com, or check out all the content on our network, HC Universal, at hcuniversalnetwork.com.